I call this series The Highest Public Calling because from very early in Western civilization, politics has been considered the highest public calling. And I call it that because it's become very clear to me that both the kind of public discourse that we often have around political issues looks to me often like two different competing ideologies in two separate silos shooting mortar fire at each other. And so the wonderful thing about politics, which is the opportunity to think together about how we are going to live and shape our common life, disappears in so much of that. So I have wanted to do the little bit that I can do through the Ronning Center of what I call pour the oil of gladness on public discourse and debate. That is, soften things up. Not to diminish people's strongly held perspectives, but to call them forth in the best way they can be called forth so we can really talk together and think together and figure out what to do about difference. So I'm delighted tonight that we have James with us. I first got to know him, well, really met him through my daughter, who was in a class with him, and in a class with him under Professor Don Carmichael, who I've asked to introduce James. Just want to say one other thing about the Ronning Center. There's some materials at the back that we published and the newsletter and some forms. If you want to find out what we're up to, you can just fill that out, and I'm happy to put you on the list. So I'm delighted you're here and that we can listen to you and engage you in conversation. Our normal pattern is to have the politicians speak for a period of time on these large matters of their sense of vocation and the large issues that we face and need to think about in our society, and then to engage in a conversation together with them. So we'll do that tonight. So Don, please, come and introduce your student and also a person who you have played hockey against. No.
When I was asked to introduce James, I was delighted. I was also very honored for reasons I'll mention in a moment. But I was very honored because it's a session I wanted to come to. My name is Don Carmichael. I'm a political philosopher at the University in Edmonton. And I've known James for a long time. I imagine he, for all of you, is a man who needs no introduction. At least I'll just say briefly, I presume you know he's been a member of Parliament for this area since 2000. And in that capacity, in addition to being an exemplary parliamentarian and representative of the area, he's also been chairman of two really important parliamentary committees, one on industry and most recently now on finance. So I know James from a distance in that way, but I know him personally and have known him for a long time in two other ways. The first, as David mentioned, probably the most important is hockey. But David actually was sticking the knife to me and saying that because I have to confess that James is a slightly better player than I am. Very slightly. I would say all the times we ever played, I never once beat him, and he always beat me. But
I'm less intense than you are.
Well, the other way I've known James was he once was a student in classes of mine, and then through that became a friend, and now comes regularly to the university to appear in my classes and in other classes. I wasn't going to say anything about this, but since classical philosophers came up, I will just say my favorite philosopher is Aristotle. And Aristotle regarded the two most challenging and worthy parts of a person's life to be contemplation and practical service in the community. And in the ending part of Aristotle's great work on the Nicomachean Ethics, he poses the question, tries to sort out which of these is the more important. Well, I mentioned that only because James strikes me, has always struck me, as a man who's exemplary through his commitment in each respect. And one way I've seen this is when he, I just want to tell one story of this, when he comes to classes at the university, ordinarily, you know, people come into classes and students are just awestruck, an MP and famous and so on. And so they expect the person to tell them stuff. Right? Well, the first time James appeared in a class of mine, it was an honors seminar, and I had all the students introduce themselves to James by telling him briefly their names and what they liked, but what their honors projects were. And when they got to the very end, James imitated this himself. He said, well, my name is James Rajat, and I'm a member of parliament, and I like hockey and these things. And he said, but now, he said, Don has made you all tell me what you're writing your honors thesis on. What I'd like to know is what you really care about. So could we go around? So he had them go around the room again, and this time he just asked people to say what they really cared about. And, you know, like with a lot of students, they can be shy, and they were sort of nervous with James there. And if they were stuck, what he would do was, like, ask them a prompting question. The first one I remember was, well, what books have you read that you like? I'm an MP and I don't have a lot of time to read. So, like, what books have you read that you think I should read? And what followed was this wonderful, just wonderful, three-hour seminar of discussion on public affairs that were deeply reflective. And that's my sense of James, a man who cares deeply about public affairs and the health of the community, thinks about it, and has a very strong commitment to improving not just our lives as citizens, but the quality of our ability to debate and consider our destinies as citizens. So when I was asked to introduce him, I was delighted because I'd already seen that he was on the program, and I decided I was going to come out to hear it anyway because I really look forward to what you have to say, James.
Well, thank you all for coming out tonight. It's a real pleasure to be here. I do want to thank, in particular at the outset, three very distinguished gentlemen. Don, who, as you mentioned, has become a friend. He was a professor who was very inspiring, and I remember taking night classes from Don, and we share the same passion for Aristotle as a philosopher, but it was a class he taught on Thomas Hobbes, and I remember leaving the class, and Dominic, I'm sure, has had his same feeling because he's had a class from Don. You felt so alive. Your mind was just racing in all sorts of directions with all sorts of questions. It's a real tribute to be introduced by Don tonight. I do want to thank David, and I first met David actually when he gave a talk in front of the Coptic community in Edmonton, and I'm sure you remember that, David, but it was a community that David and I both have a relationship with, and he gave such an outstanding speech, and I went up to him afterwards, and then we realized the connection through his daughter, who, as Don describes, as Don Carmichael describes, lights up a room with her smile and is one of the most genuine people you'd ever meet. And I do hope you take the time to find out about the Ronning Center. It's a very unique center that people should really get involved in and certainly be informed about. I also want to thank my coffee brother, Pastor McDowell. We meet actually at the Second Cup on a fairly regular basis, and we just share a lot. And it's nice to just sit down with someone and just talk about things. And I really appreciate the time that he's given to me. And that's what this evening is about. It's not about, you know, a sort of intense political dialogue. This is more about partly why I got into public life, what public life means to me, and then opening it up for a real discussion. So I hope you all have some thoughts on that. You know, when I thought about tonight, I probably rewrote the speech six times, so I'm going to speak a little bit off the cuff. One of the things I'm going to do is actually talk about some of my own personal influences. As long as I've represented in this community, I've probably never really opened up about some of the things I've done as a young person. And I grew up with strong Roman Catholic influences from both my mom and my dad's side and from my grandparents. And in fact, the first thing I wanted to be was not a politician, and it was not a hockey player, as most Canadians want to be. It was, I wanted to be a prophet. I wanted to be a prophet because my Nana, my Irish grandmother, had given me a Synoptic Bible, and I read through it, and the New Testament is very appealing, but I have to say, as a young child, the Old Testament is just very exciting. But I came to her one day, and I said, Nana, I'm going to be a prophet just like Elijah. And she was very Irish and very Catholic and very proper, and so her eyes went like this, and she said, that's not a good thing for a young man these days. You could be Pope, but you cannot be a prophet. She just saw me walking around in a coatless sandals and thought, oh my goodness. So, but it, you know, this was certainly one of the heavy influences in my life. My father went to, I think, one of the greatest schools in North America, Notre Dame College in Saskatchewan, which was founded by Father Alpha Murray, who I think is one of the greatest Canadians of all time. And if you want to ask during the Q&A session, I can go on about him. But he moved out from Toronto to the prairies, established a school, and taught thousands of young men, and partnered with Mother Edith at the convent there. And the number of young Canadians that they taught who then went on to positions, people like, obviously people like Jason Kenney, who went to that school. I mean, it's just outstanding to see the influence they have, and it has. If you go to Wilcox, Saskatchewan, now don't blink because you'll miss it as you drive through, but it has one of the greatest rare book collections in North America. It also has, if you go in, it has a church, St. Augustine's, that was Father Murray's favorite saint, but it also has a Tower of God. And so one of the influences of my father, he walked in, and there's a tower, there's a wall to Judaism, a wall to Christianity, and a wall to Islam, and then there's a wall to humanity. And for a Catholic priest to move from Toronto to locate in the prairies, to build a school out of nothing, and then to have testament to the three great faiths and the humanity, it's a very inspiring thing, and I encourage everyone to go out and see it for themselves. Some of the other influences, in terms of political influences, the important thing I want to mention is in my family it was all about a dialogue. And it was about a dialogue between people who often disagreed on things. So at the kitchen table, my father, who is not nearly as conservative as I am on the political spectrum, it was always a dialogue about, you think this is the right issue, or you think this is the right approach, explain to me why. And it was a dialogue between two people who loved each other and respected each other. And even if we disagreed at the end of the discussion, the respect was still there and the love was still there. And that certainly struck me throughout my entire life. And the other strong influence on my life was my grandma from the U.S., who I'd go down every summer, and every summer she'd have a stack of books and she'd say, let's read through these. And I don't know if any of you read Theodore H. White and his series on the American presidential elections, which are just outstanding. And she used to share with me so much of the history, bring out the old clippings of FDR and JFK and just go through them with me. And again, she didn't often share my political views, but we just had a wonderful dialogue. And that's one of the things I want to emphasize tonight is one of the things I most believe in is dialogue. Is if you don't disagree with someone, sit down and have a discussion. Because even if you don't change your mind, you may even become more firmly convinced in your own position, but you'll actually have a better understanding of those who don't share your position, and you'll actually probably have a better understanding of why you should have the position you did in the first place. But in this talk tonight, and in the notice that went out, it talked about two things in particular. It talked about reflecting on the place of faith and the formation, on how religious discipline, ideas, and values were at work in molding aspirations and judgments of people in political life. And it talked about the complex nature of decision-making in the context of competing values and responsibilities. And it's interesting in terms of the importance of faith, a very strong personal faith, but I have to say, and it may be a bit of a contrarian view, and it's something I'd like to hear from all of you, but I always hesitate when people say, whether it's in politics or sports or whatever field, when people sort of say God is on our side. And I think the strongest sentiments that you can ask for as political leaders is for people to pray for strength from God and for wisdom from God, so that you make the right decisions, and you make the right decisions in the right way. Because we're all human beings, we're all fallible, we're all imperfect, We cannot know the mind of God, or we only know it to a certain extent, and so we have to ask for strength and wisdom from God. I think the examples of King Solomon in the Bible are certainly examples along those lines. But the one thing which really impacted me, I have to say, when I went to Washington, D.C., and I visited the Lincoln Memorial, how many people here have had that experience? It's something, put it on your list of things to do. You go in there and you read the second inaugural address, and I actually put it down here, so when I do want to quote from it, because it talked about the battle between the North and the South. He says, neither party expected for the war the magnitude or the duration which it has already attained. Neither anticipated that the cause of the conflict might cease with, or even before the conflict itself should cease. Each looked for an easier triumph and a result less fundamental and astounding. Both read the same Bible and prayed to the same God, and each invokes his aid against the other. It may seem strange that any men should dare to ask a just God's assistance in wringing their bread from the sweat of other men's faces. But let us judge not, that we be not judged. The prayers of both cannot be answered. That of neither has been fully answered. The Almighty has his own purposes. And that, to me, had a strong impression on me, in the sense of it's us as political leaders to obviously ask for support, but for people to pray for us in terms of strength and wisdom, but not necessarily to believe that God is on our side. I mean, that's just one of the things, and I think during the discussion period we can get into that in a more full way. In terms of some of the other influences, and perhaps being raised Catholic, but the combination of Aristotelian philosophy and St. Thomas, and the view that faith and reason can be melded together. Faith and reason are not two separate corners. They can, in fact, be brought together. I believe that very strongly. Don was a heavy influence in that area in terms of reading St. Thomas Aquinas, St. Augustine, and all their thoughts, and showing that faith and reason, in fact, can coexist together. It's unfortunate that in a modern society, a lot of people have separated the two and have said there's no reason in faith or no faith in reason. And that's, to me, one of the tragedies of modern philosophy, and something, again, that we could certainly talk about later. The second area of discussion was sort of the complex nature of decision-making. And this is something I can talk at length about. But it is something, when I speak to university students or even junior high students or anyone, I try to impress upon them the complexities of making a decision. And the reality, I'll do it with some case studies in terms of how you make this decision in the right way or the wrong way. But it is astounding when you end Parliament, the amount of decisions that are made on a daily basis that impact people's lives. And frankly, when you go to Ottawa, when I arrived in Ottawa in the year 2000, it is very intimidating, because there's all sorts of departments: finance, justice, immigration, defense, foreign affairs, trade, all sorts of areas. It's a little overwhelming at first. And I remember a Liberal MP I ran into, John Godfrey. He's introduced himself, and he said, you're a new MP. I'm just going to give you a piece of advice, take it for what it's worth. But focus. If you're here, focus on a few areas. Pick some areas of interest to you and focus. Because if you try to be a specialist on everything, you will accomplish nothing, and you will leave here a very frustrated person. And that's why I have tried to focus in certain areas. And Don mentioned finance and justice, but with private members' bills, focusing on identity theft, or Alzheimer's, or now financial literacy, picking some areas that you can have some impact. Because I'll say very candidly, it may be different. I know Dominic and Greg would certainly be aware of everything that goes on in Leduc, but I have to say candidly, in Ottawa, I'll come out of a committee meeting, reporter will have a microphone stuck in my face and say, what do you think about this decision this morning of the Supreme Court? And I'll have been in finance committee for 3 hours, and I will have no idea what they're talking about. And I will look at them and say, I'm sorry, I've been in a committee. And they'll say, well, how can you possibly not know? It's a groundbreaking decision. I said, well, I'm doing this, I'm focused in this area. And that's one of the challenges, is there's just so many demands on your time in Ottawa in that role. Plus, when you come to the constituency, it's a completely different role. It's frankly like you have two jobs. Because in Ottawa, the parliamentary role is very different than the role you have here. Here, you're very much meeting with members of the community, Frankly, it's on whatever issue that they have to bring forward to you, whether it's a cell phone tower going up in a neighborhood, whether it's funding for municipalities, whether it's, frankly, you know, even we get approached on municipal or provincial issues, obviously on things like health care. But anything that is of a concern to a constituent, they can bring up with you here. And you have to do your best to respond. That's where you have to be more of a generalist and try to respond as best as you can. And that's where, you know, I return again to the, you know, asking for people to pray for wisdom, because it is about political judgment. It is really about political judgment. And one of the plays that Don and I study together and we both love is a play called Antigone. And it's about, it's a whole story, but it's in the Oedipus saga. And Antigone is one of the daughters of Oedipus, and she does something. I should tell the whole story here, Don. But she goes against the wishes of the king, and the king is her uncle Creon. And her king believes that he's acting in the best interest of the state and actually sentences her to death. It's a very tragic story, and he goes through with it. But he thinks he's acting in the interest of the state, but what the play shows is that he's actually acting in his own interest. He's confusing the interests of the state with his own interests. And when he commits this grievous act, and he realizes it at the end, his humanity makes him realize this. But it shows the difference between a tyrant and a king, which is another theme of Aristotle, is the tyrant acts in his interest, the king acts in the interest of the community. But on that, and that's why the second question that David asked in terms of the complexity is, how do you determine the interests of the community? How do you determine what the city of Leduc wants or wishes on a certain issue? It's a very challenging issue, and it goes back to the question I said earlier about we ask for strength to make the right decision, but to make the right decision in the right way. And an example on that, and again, I'll use something that's going on in our constituency right now in a community in Edmonton, is a cell phone tower is going up. And that community feels like there has been no consultation whatsoever. And I'm trying to explain to the company, you may feel you're acting rightly or it's the right thing to do, but the manner in which you are doing it is not the right way. You have to consult with the community so that you feel, as I did in having a discussion with my father, he may not agree with me, and we may not agree at the end, but he let me argue my point, and I let him argue his point, and at the end of it, even if we didn't change our mind, we both felt better for having the discussion, which is the importance in a democracy of having that dialogue and that discussion. And the reason you have that dialogue is for another word that starts with D, is for deliberation. And this is another thing that I studied a lot at university and have a passion for, which is deliberation can happen in two ways. It can happen where we have a conversation and Dominic says something and I go away and I think, wow, you really made an impression on me by making that point, and I should perhaps change my mind, or maybe I won't change my mind, but that's a good point that he raised. But deliberation also occurs within us. It occurs when we read a good book, and we go away and we think, you know, that was really a good point, or someone wrote an editorial, and we feel they made a good point. We should think and challenge ourselves all the time in terms of what we believe and what we don't believe and why we believe that. Now, the final thing I'll do here before opening up for questions and comments is talk a little bit about respect for political life and respect for political people. And, you know, when David first approached me, he said, would you like to do one of these? And I said, I'd love to do one because I'd like to humanize politicians a little more. And maybe that's self-interested, but, you know, in the year 2000, I went and sat down with Mom and Dad, and I said, you know, I've worked in politics, I've studied political science, the nomination is open at that time at Edmonton Southwest, so I'd like to put my name forward. And my dad got excited, and he said, oh, this would be great, it'd be wonderful if you could do this. And my mom looked at me and said, isn't there another way for you to contribute to the community? You know, that's not a good reaction from a mom, right? That's not a good statement on political life. And frankly, I can tell you, as soon as I became a politician, you sort of, even with people that have known you all your life, you sort of lose a bit of your humanity. It's like you become this something other, you become this person here that's sort of separate. And that's not a good thing, and that's not healthy, and that's something I'd certainly like to change, and that's why I love the work that David is doing in this area. You know, it's And that's why we have these sorts of things. And that's why, frankly, as citizens, and frankly, I encourage even my own parents, is they'll read something in the paper and react very quickly, and I'll say, you know, just bring yourself back. Put yourself in their shoes. Think about what they're doing or how they're making a decision. And I told Don this story, but I did it even, frankly, in my own office when the Arab Spring was occurring, and I had a lady in my office of Lebanese descent, and she came in, and we were having a discussion, and she said, your government's all wrong in the Arab Spring. They're not doing anything right. And she went on and on. I said, well, okay, let's have a dialogue about what we could do better and how we could change things. And she kept saying, you know, it's just your minister, he doesn't know what he's doing. And I said, okay. So I took my pad of paper, which was empty, and I turned it around, I put it in front of her, and I put the pen there, and I said, whatever you write on that pad of paper, this was on a Saturday, I said, I will give to the Minister of Foreign Affairs on Monday. Whatever you write down as to how he should do his job better, I will take it to him and give it right to him. It will go right to him, unfiltered. And she looked at the paper and looked at me. She said, yeah, it's a little harder than I think, isn't it? I said, it is. I said, if you have a way for Canadians to be more active and more proactive and help, I'm all for listening to that. But it's always easier to sit on the sidelines. It's always easier to sit outside the arena. It's always harder to be in the arena or inside making the decisions, because whatever decision you make, there will always be consequences. There will always be people who disagree with the decision that you make. No decision you can make. And this political leadership, frankly, extends to all forms of leadership. Frankly, if you want to feel sympathy for someone in a position of leadership, go to a condo board meeting. The last one I was at, I went up and I hugged the chair. I said, Joan, I don't know. This is a volunteer. I don't know how you do this. I mean, and frankly, one of the persons stood up and said, you know, all the people who are criticizing Joan, why don't you run for the board? She's done this for 7 years and she doesn't want to do it. And they said, no, we'd rather sit in the audience and complain at her. So this, frankly, applies to all forms of political leadership. But that's why we need to keep up the dialogue between people who are citizens, very active citizens, and those who are in positions of political leadership. Now, I want to finish with a quote from one of the books I read recently, which I love. It's a little hard on politicians in some way, but it's very instructive in other ways. It's from a British journalist called Jeremy Paxman, and it's called The Political Animal. And his quote is, politicians exist because we disagree. All societies need to decide how to protect themselves, how to organize themselves, how to share out their resources, and the alternative to force of argument is force of fists. The creation of politics is therefore a proof of civilization. So although the existence of politics may be a mark of human frailty, politics itself matters, and it matters that politics is practiced by good people. As in most walks of life, people go into the trade with a variety of motives, some noble, some vain. Most seem to be genuinely convinced that they can make the world a better place. Some of them have done so. A small number genuinely deserve to be called great. I do not believe they are all scoundrels. That's a wonderful, I think that's a wonderful way of putting exactly what it is we do. And so at this point, I'd like to open it up and encourage you for your thoughts and comments. And
Tom, suggestions. Would you like to begin?
Well, I wonder if I could ask you to say a little bit more on one of the things. I have the impression, but as a newspaper reader, not like you from inside or Dom or others inside the process, I have the impression that over my lifetime, and especially over the last 10 years, that respect for the political process and people in it seems to have gone down. I think when I was younger, let's say a college-age student or a young adult, even when people disagreed intensely with a politician, they spoke to and of the politician with respect. And the idea seemed to be not mainly to respect the politician, but to respect the flag, the country, like that the politician was part of our public life. So I wonder whether you think I'm right in seeing that that respect has gone down. And if you do, like, what's going on? What explains, what kinds of things explain that?
Yeah, I think you're correct. I think respect is going down, unfortunately. I think there are a few reasons. There are a number of reasons for that. One of them, it's interesting, Bill Blakey, a former NDP MP who you know well, I remember chatting with him one time about this, about, you know, sort of bemoaning the lack of respect for us. And he said, realistically, James, we don't show a lot of our respect for each other to the media or to the Canadian public. So if we don't show that respect to each other, we can't expect that respect from citizens who are voting for us or not voting for us. I mean, that would be one point. A second point would be the influence of the media. If there's probably two things in Ottawa that genuinely shocked me. And one is, I mean, I thought, as a political scientist, so I know the influence of the media. I really had no comprehension of the dramatic influence of the media in terms of setting the agenda every day and reporting on it. And I think moving, frankly, to a bit more of the gotcha journalism, because it's a 24/7 news cycle. They have to fill that thing every 10 minutes. They have to have a new story. And so it's easier to do a quick story on sort of a scandal rather than a thoughtful piece on the future of healthcare in Canada. And as, you know, Preston Manning, when I bemoan about the media, he'd say, well, he said, yeah, they never show the planes that land, do they? And then he'd say, well, to complain about, you know, complaining about the media is complaining about the weather in Canada. It's not going to change. So. But even there, I've done my part to sort of challenge individual journalists. Because, frankly, if you go and have a coffee with them, they may share some of the same things. And you say, well, why don't you show them, like, why don't you just talk about what an NP is doing with a private member's bill? Just to sort of show people that there is, in fact, a lot of work going on. But there's a number of reasons for that. I think as well, though, the role of the member of parliament has changed. You know, when I got there, there was an MP there who had been first elected in the early 1970s. And he said, James, he said, the job is completely different. When I got elected, I was in BC. I took the train in September to Ottawa. I stayed there until December. I took the train in December back to BC. In January, I took the train back to Ottawa until the end of June, and I took the train back to BC. He said, this flying back and forth every weekend, your BlackBerry now where everybody can reach you 24/7. He said, this is a completely different job, and it's really changed the nature of it. The other thing he also said is a funny story, which may not be funny to some of you, but we have these lobbies. You have the House of Commons, and then you have these two lobbies, a government lobby and opposition lobby. And he said, like, for instance, these lobbies, he said, everybody here is working on their BlackBerry, on their cell phone, faxing things, checking their email. He said, when I got elected, I mean, these tables, you were either drinking, gambling, or smoking, or doing all three. He said, I don't understand this. So his comment was actually politicians were working harder, but actually probably being more criticized now than they were back then.
That comes to the whole issue of contemplation that you opened up initially here in Aristotle, the notion that contemplation as well as service in some ways need to walk hand in hand with each other. And how is there room for that?
Yeah, Don, I actually wrote a paper for Don on what Aristotle thought about what's the higher life, the contemplative life or the political life.
Where did you come down?
Well, the answer is the contemplative life.
Yeah. Well, how do you, how do you, like in that BlackBerry universe, find time for life and reflection?
It's very difficult. It's near to impossible because it is, you know, there's a saying in Ottawa, the urgent overtakes the important all the time. And unfortunately, it is very hard to find that time. Frankly, one of the times is when you're on an airplane because you have 4 hours when people can't reach you. So you can actually focus or do something else. But it is very hard. I mean, the one thing that members of parliament, they don't have enough of is their own time. And that's just the reality of the, I don't know how you can change that. You know, Henry Kissinger once said, once you enter political life, your intellectual, you sort of draw down on your intellectual capacity, and if you want to restore it, you have to leave and work on it.
Has it been, Mr. Mayor, has it been difficult for you as well?
Well, certainly I think that if you don't have a passion for it, if you don't believe in that what you're doing is providing some value to the community or to the country, you shouldn't be doing it. And so it's a sacrifice. It's not really as much a sacrifice for me, because I'm passionate about what I do. I love what I'm doing. But the family suffers. And because they're, you know, I was contemplating what I was going to say tomorrow on Friday at Remembrance Day, and I realized that I'd already put in 55 hours since Monday morning on city business and eaten only like 4 meals at home. And so how do you maintain that balance with the family without ending up losing your family? And so the contemplation that I need to do is, how can I do a better job of balancing that? Because, you know, you can give the service, but eventually you can lose yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. See, one good example with Greg, I mean, like, take the example now of you going shopping, you know, when you go to Sobeys now versus 8 years ago.
Joanne won't go shopping. Like, she'll just say, I'm going to go on my own. Because it takes twice as long to shop.
Like, if I need bread and I'm going to Safeway next to my office, I see if I have an hour. Because, you know, James, can you handle this casework for me in immigration? So you're sort of writing notes there. Which, I mean, that's, you're there MP, that's your role. So it's not something to complain about, it's just a reality that you have to take into account.
There was one here first. Yeah. Please.
Well, it seems to me that when we talk on issues now, that the first response is the name call. So whatever side, you're either, you know, you're left, you're right, you're some sort of phobia, you want American-style health care, whatever, that we have labels that you say, oh, well, that's your position, right? And so you don't ever, it's hard to get to actually talk about the issues and have an intelligent discussion, because people already formulate, well, this is your position, and they think they know your position, because they've got a label for you. And I was wondering, do you find that, and how do you get past that?
Oh, that's absolutely correct. In fact, I mean, a good example, I was watching, an American news program with my dad during the whole debate over healthcare with Obama, and whatever your position on it. I mean, the rhetoric on both sides was very strong. But during the program, I turned to my dad and I said, could you tell me what Obama's plan is and what the Republican plan is? And he said, I have no idea. And these are intelligent people on television commenting, but it was all about the strategy or the back and forth or the combative political battle, rather than, okay, explain to me what the plan is and let me analyze whether that would help or not. And frankly, 95% of what we do in Ottawa, it's almost like an iceberg. It's all below the surface, and the 5% is shown as it's the most controversial part. But you start talking to someone about something substantive, because that actually makes, when they get down to the issues, there's less confrontation, frankly. Yeah. But there's confrontation, as David said at the outset, in terms of political ideas back and forth. That's good debate. That's good partisanship. We should encourage that. It's a good cluster. But the sort of spitefulness or personal attacks, which, you know, frankly, all parties do and we shouldn't do, that's the kind of stuff that detracts from the issues.
When you're working in committee, for example, is this the way it works, or is there other things going on there?
It's a very interesting question. In committee, because it's 12 members, it's smaller, it's easier to form bonds. And our committee of finance, we traveled, and it was interesting. Before the travel, it was a little more combative. After the travel, people get to know each other a little bit. But also, as the chair, you can sort of encourage people to dialogue and say, you know, fight over the hills that are important to you, but if that issue is not really important, why not give it to the other side or let them have a smaller victory? Now, in a minority situation, for our side, I just simply said to them, my dad's a math teacher and 7 beats 4 every time, so we as a minority we've got to get somebody over on our side in some way. And that's the way it needs to work. In a majority, you have the majority, but there's still so many things in the parliament in procedure that requires unanimous consent. One of the things was today. We had a unanimous consent on our pre-budget, when to present it. And that's where parties realize they better form some relationships across the aisle. But they do get to know each other more as human beings, which helps the dialogue, especially during the tougher times.
A few years ago, when the Ronnie Center was first formed, we had a bit of a gathering, and I had Walter McLean, you know, Walter McLean, who was in Prime Minister Mulroney's cabinet, did a lot of work internationally. He's a Presbyterian.
Presbyterians?
Our
founder was a Presbyterian.
That's right, he was. I sometimes refer to them as God's frozen people. I don't know that anymore. In any case, Walter's a wonderful, wonderful person. And I also had Mr. Blakey there. And on Saturday morning, early, invited some people for breakfast with him. And one of the other people who came was the MP from Camrose, who also had part of the military portfolio. What's his name?
Kevin Sorensen.
No, this is a...
Oh, Leon Benoit.
No, before him, too. I'm sorry. I'm ashamed of myself that his name is escaping. But at one point, these three men who had all served, or one of them was still serving, Mr. Blakey, but the others, of course, have been retired for some time. At one point, it seemed to me that they took their party hats off. And they started talking about the committee work they'd done internationally, particularly in Africa and India. And it was a wonderful conversation. They also talked about the Scots they drank together. Several of them were Presbyterian, Scots, Calvinists. So, I mean, that made a difference to them, I suppose. But it was to see that as they were statesmen, they were concerned about public life and about how you can make a difference in these places. So it occurred to me then, I mean, that's the most vivid example I've seen, that there are these times, and that it would be wonderful to figure out how to pull it forward. This is my little way of trying to pull it forward a little bit, because I think it makes a huge difference to how we think of the political process. It heightens our regard, and it helps us understand just how modest our abilities are in any of those contexts. So I'm not surprised to hear you say in committee it does make it functions a bit differently.
Yeah, it also helps if you do something socially or the committee. That's why committee travel, we do a lot less because of the finances, but you know, when we had our industry committee traveling on our manufacturing study, we were in a little lounge in Saskatoon, and a lady was serving us, and there was four parties there, and so her daughter was studying political science at the University of Saskatchewan, and she said, "Oh, you're members of Parliament. What party are you?" And we said, "Well, Conservative, Liberal, Bloc, NDP." And she said, "No, seriously, what party are you?" And we all said, "Oh, we're all sitting here chatting, teasing each other, and you know, the next day we're going to disagree completely on all sorts of issues, and that's fine, but there's no reason why you can't share a meal." And she was just shocked and took a picture and our names and sent it to her daughter.
And to each of your bosses, assuming.
Yeah.
Does that satisfy you?
Yeah.
Please.
My name's James.
Hi, James. How are you?
It's been a while since I ran the sidewalks for you.
Yeah.
But I would like your comments on the topic of respect for the law. And the reason I ask that is, I think what came up the most in town here, we do have a pretty law-abiding town, but there's a whole bunch of train cars parked over by the elevator, and if you drive by, especially on the other side, there's large, large graffiti. The very first car, we're talking with huge letters, big, is F blank 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 the law. And then all the rest of the cars are really decorated up pretty brightly. So I would just like your comment with respect to, you know, law-abiding society. Other things involving, like, occupations, which are all over to some degree, they're law-abiding, to some degree they aren't. People driving while distracted, and I'm somewhat guilty of that. And people working for cash. So these are some of the things that I just thought about when it comes to respect for the law and your comments on this.
Well, I think your respect, although it may even go, it may even be broader. I think you're right in terms of respect for the law, but I think it goes to what Don was saying earlier in terms of respect for people in positions of authority. And, you know, that you've seen a sea change in that in the last, I would say, 30 to 40 years, unfortunately. You know, the way, and my parents are both teachers, and they could tell you at the start of their career to when the end of their career, the language that was used by kids towards teachers changed dramatically. So I would say it would extend to all sorts. And the fact, you know, respect towards law, you look at law enforcement societies, I mean, if you've ever seen, you know, whether it's RCMP officers or soldiers or police, yes, there are cases where there are clear cases of abuse, and those should be dealt with severely. But in most cases, if you've ever seen a riot, you've seen these officers try as best they can to try to calm the situation. That's what they want to do, frankly. They don't want the situation to get out of hand. And sometimes they're not effective at doing that. But again, I would say the same thing when I turn the pat around to the person, is put yourself in the shoes of having a very large crowd and trying to control them, contain them, calm them down, make sure nobody gets hurt. I mean, that is a very difficult job, which unfortunately we seem to have less respect for now than we used to. And in terms of respect for the law, I mean that's a huge area we could get into, but you know, that's something that unfortunately I'd say over the last 30 years there has been a decline in respect for it. Now I would say majority of the people still do, but there are people who just, for whatever reason, it's disrespect, but it's sort of disrespect without a purpose. Like, that's what I'm finding is, you know, I don't mind people who disagree with this law or that law and argue against it and over time seek to change it. That's what you do in a parliamentary democracy. But while that law is the law, then that law should be respected. And it goes both ways. You know, I remember when we were in opposition, and frankly when we were traveling abroad, some members of other parties would say, when we travel abroad, like the law in Canada, you may want to change it with respect to all sorts of things, firearm registry, weak board, but you have to represent the position of the law as it currently is in Canada. You can say privately you'd like to change it, but you have to show respect for the process that has gone into in that law that is in place at that time. In terms of the cars and that and the graffiti, I don't know if the mayor wants to comment on that.
I would suggest that we improve art education. And I think if we improve art education in our school system, we see at least much better.
Some of that
probably better spelling.
Some of that art is all that bad. It's just the first thing.
I'll come to you in a minute.
One of the things that I've got to notice with both practicing politics and studying politics at the same time was both the evolution of the politician throughout history and the evolution of the citizen throughout history. And as a politician, one of the things that I really started to recognize is the understanding of the role of citizen. When it started off, the unique thing about democracy, politicians exist in many different systems, but the role of the citizen in democracy is the most unique and the most authority giving. So I'm curious to know if you have any thoughts about the evolution of the role of the citizen throughout history and ways to re-engage them to become what they were initially intended to do, and that has kind of the check on good politics.
Yeah, that's very interesting, and I think Don and David could give a much better history of the citizen, but although what's quite interesting, if you look at sort of Greek democracy where it started, I mean, the citizenship was very restricted, which was wrong. But of those people who were citizens, the power was much more broadly shared in the sense of, you know, actually, you were almost just drafted and you had to serve in a position of leadership for 1 year. As you know, in the classic Greek polis, you know, obviously they got away from that. But in terms of citizenship now, like when people come to me and sort of say, I have no power to change this, I say to them, I can't think of many other countries in the world where you have more power, more influence to actually change something than here in Canada. And they'll say, well, give me an example. And I'll say, well, I'll give you a few. In the 2006 budget, it was changed so that all your stocks and bonds you could write, you could change so all your capital gains tax, you used to pay capital gains tax if you donated it to a charity. As of the 2006 budget, you no longer pay tax if you donate your stocks and bonds to a charity. Now, did that happen because I proposed it? No. Stephen Harper, it wasn't his idea. It wasn't Jim Flaherty's. It wasn't anyone in our parties. It was a retired banker from Toronto named Donald Johnson who fought for years to get this change in, and was in a pre-budget report. Finance department said, yeah, it's a good idea. Here's the cost, but it is a good idea. And it was in a 2006 budget. A lot of the actions with regards to vehicle theft was Ken Haywood from Kentwood Ford from here in Edmonton, who fought for years to get vehicle identification numbers, get an auto theft legislation, which was brought in over the last 5 years. So citizens can have a real impact. And I know a lot of people feel they can't see through sort of the traditional political party structure, but in fact, you know, I think there's 2% of people who belong to political parties. You can have a tremendous amount of influence on who that leader is, how that leader operates, how that constitution operates. You can have a tremendous amount of influence. You know, I just give the example of myself. I mean, this son of two school teachers, 30 years old, elected to the national parliament. Now, some people, my critics, may say that's a tragedy, but that's I think it says something special about our country that people, you know, in this community would say, here's a 30-year-old, and we're going to entrust this person to represent us, and that represent us in Parliament.
Especially when your mother questioned it.
Yeah. Although I have to point out, now she watches me vote, so you know, I said, Mom, you need to do something else than watching me vote.
She watches C-SPAN.
Yeah, she CPAC.
So a lot of people think that there's civic responsibility ends at the ballot box. They mark their ballot, and that's kind of it. Is there anything that you personally do to try to get citizens engaged and really thinking that their role as a citizen goes beyond just that vote and communication with you and those types of things?
Well, yeah, so, I mean, certainly, like, electronically now, it is much easier to communicate. So we, you know, we email people about twice a month and say, here's what's going on in Parliament, and try to update people. One of the things my office did, which I don't think any other MP has done, but we actually took each bill and we did a little summary and we handed it out to people, we emailed it out to people. And, you know, I have to say, I know this is being recorded, but our own party leadership said, I'm not sure people would be interested. It's, you know, it's very technical. And all I did was a title and a little summary and a web link. So we did that. About 40 MPs in our own caucus came to me and said, can I have this? And distributed out to their people to say, here's something that we're doing. Now, so that's one thing, is informing. Obviously, then it's collecting information or having that dialogue back and forth. And on that point, it's important to just say to people, you know, you are willing to dialogue. In terms of the best forms, it's becoming increasingly challenging because town halls typically would get, you know, 100 plus people, say, when I started. Now when we have a town hall, we'll get 50 some people. So we just try to do new and different ways of doing that, whether it's small coffee parties, round tables. Mike Light does regular round tables as an MP with about 15 people. He finds these effective. In the last campaign, we tried something. We did a telephone town hall. I don't know if any of you heard it, but we phoned, you know, we phoned about 40,000 people. We had over 9,000 people stay on the call during that hour, which is just remarkable in terms of connecting with people. So you sort of have to try to harness the technology as a better way of doing that. The other thing, I mean, obviously speaking at high schools, junior highs, university classes, forums like this, so it's just there's sort of an endless list of things you can do.
Do you have thoughts on?
Well, I guess it's kind of more the grand question, because if you take a look at the ancient Greek citizens, or even if you take more of a look at Mill time and trying to look at citizenship then, and when he was proposing citizenship reform or the ability to participate in politics, they didn't have Facebook, Twitter, phone town halls. But if you were to take a look at the quality of participation between the elected official and the people they're accounted to, I think that their relationship would be really, really well intact. The space for discussion, those types of things created. And Definitely there's been technology increases, but is there something that you see larger in society that can be kind of contributed to? Where did the lack, or where did the idea of citizenship just being drop your ballot so I can complain idea from? It's a constant discussion with the elected leadership.
I don't know if I can pinpoint where or what exactly. I mean, I think part of it has to do with the size of our constituencies. I mean, in Aristotle's time, his view was a polis, a city-state, you should know the character of each everyone else in that state, right? Right now, you know, with 125,000, 130,000 people in one constituency, it's very challenging to sort of have that dialogue. One thing I think, frankly, we should do more of, and I'm a bit of an outlier on this, is I think we should have more plebiscites. People say, well, referendums. I'd actually like to go to people to energize them and say, just give us some views on this. So don't worry about if you make a decision, it's like the HST. I mean, people can disagree about that, but it had severe consequences. But almost get, like we were heading towards healthcare talk. So let's have a discussion, and then let's have some input on a series of questions. One of the things about the Charlottetown Accord, I mean, I opposed it at the time, but I did like the fact it caused people to have a debate about the Constitution and to say, here's my view of what should happen. Here's, but it also informed a bunch of people who had to dust off an old book and say, okay, what is our Constitution anyways? What is Section 24 or 26? So that would certainly be one way, I think, of energizing a number of people. So I don't know if you have any thoughts on it.
No, well, that's really the theme of what I was looking for. It wasn't, hold more Facebook fan pages and that kind of stuff, but really, how do you engage citizens? And I think those are great suggestions, trying to get people in discussing the main documents of politics and really understanding their responsibility as a citizen, and I think that helps strengthen your responsibility as a leadership or leader.
Thank you.
Please. I thought it was interesting that you mentioned at the beginning that you wanted to be a prop. So what happens if you get your wish? I must just make the assumption that that's what your nan was alluding to, because we all know how the Old Testament prophets ended up.
Yeah.
So what happens, I find it really interesting, if you're in political life like you are, and you have your own deep views, and you know the Old Testament, and you get a Jeremiah where you have to go to the populace with a decision that you know that they are not going to like, and it's going to cost you your career. How do you prepare yourself for something like that, or do you even think about something like that?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Yeah, really good question.
Yeah, that's, you really have to decide, because you never agree with your party 100% of the time. You never agree with your leader 100% of the time. You have to decide what you're going to do. And you have to, the piece of advice I was given was, you think about which hills you're going to die on, and because that is going to happen. There was a vote recently in the House of Commons on asbestos, and I voted against my party on it, and I was one of five to do so. And my own reading of that issue had just said I can't vote that way. And I said to the whip after, I said, that's the way I'm voting, and whatever consequences fall me, that's a decision. But it is tough because you have responsibilities, and, I would frankly have to answer to the community as well. Like, if I did a vote and I was demoted, say I was, on number fifth chair on scrutiny of regulations, well, people like Greg or Margaret or others in this community would come to me and say, you were in a position, you worked hard to get there, and you lost all that with one vote. So that vote does have to mean something. So it does have to be a core principle. Now, the advantage in our party is on moral issues, they're all one-line votes. Maybe I should explain the voting system. So if we have three-line whips, one-line means completely free, vote however you want. Two-line is, it's recommended you vote this way, but as a backbench member out of cabinet, I can vote how I choose. Three line is what they use for the budget or for those measures, and then you have to you have to vote with the government. You could choose not to, but then there could be consequences. So most VIPs, most votes are 1 or 2 line whip. But on your other point, which was very good in terms of doing something you know is right, but actually going to the population and saying, you know, this is what I believe is right, and then taking the consequences of the next election, I think you have to be ready to do that at all times, frankly.
We don't see that, right? We see, you know, they get to the edge, and then just human nature, they flip because they want to stay. And so you don't know where they stand after a while. And, you know, being in that situation, I just wanted to ask you about that, just to be real. Like you were saying, this is one of those real conversations. Is it top flight, or is it easy to just say, you know, I'm doing it because this is the way I am? Or
It's tough, and it's tough because I'll give you another recent example. So there's a bill to increase the number of members of parliament. Now, most people say to me logically, the number of members of parliament should stay the same, and you should just, if population moves within Canada, then just move the seats of the House of Commons within Canada. It's very logical. Problem is, I mean, our constitution says that if PEI has 4 senators, it has to have 4 members of the House of Commons. So you can't really reduce Manitoba or Saskatchewan or the Atlantic provinces if you're going to keep PEIs at 4. And PEI is about the same number of people in this one riding, and they have 4 MPs. So you have to increase the seats in Alberta, British Columbia, and Ontario. But now the compromise position is Quebec has not had less number of seats than it has population. So that's in the bill. So a lot of us out west and in Ontario said, well, wait a minute, why does that principle not apply to Alberta, BC, and Ontario? Which is a valid question. But there's not really a good straight answer to that, other than this country is such a set of compromises, and you know what the Prime Minister says, this is the best bill we can do right now, so either you have this bill or you have the current situation. So in that situation, I mean, are we changing our position, or are we modifying it, or are we making the best of it? I mean, that's just a real life example of the stuff we face every day.
What do you do about your Jeremiah moments?
Well, any kind of leadership, I guess I deal with that in my work. It's tough. It's easy to talk about it, but yeah, when you're in the moment, I find it surprising, even though it's me making the decision, to stand outside myself and go, oh, wow, you didn't do that very well. You folded in a cheap card table, or you did it. But it's not easy. And so when you have, what I can only imagine, a political job where it's never pleasing everybody. It's just pleasing who you can at that time. And then you have these huge core things, which is why I would think I would have an issue running for politics, because I'd be no, done. And, you know, I wouldn't be elected the next time. So how do you bring wisdom and conviction together, right?
And see, part of that is knowing, and surprisingly, I know the perception is that the leaders make all the decisions, they're all enforced top down. But often the leader will come in and say, this is the way I think we should go. And if you have a critical mass of MPs who say, I'm sorry, that's just not acceptable, then it forces a long discussion. It's happened many times in caucus, and then there'll be a change of position. Now, it's tough to talk about it because that's all internal. But when I tell that to people, they say, oh, no, Stephen Harper never changes his mind. Well, I've seen it 20 times in caucus, where he was going one direction, and the caucus said, no, I'm not comfortable with that. But it takes people, frankly, there was a moral issue internally where there was about 40 members of caucus, including 3 cabinet ministers, who said to him, and not loudly, but just, this is how we feel, and if we're voting this way, and if we're out of cabinet as a result, we're out of cabinet.
Yeah,
so, because what happens is, you know, you'll often see the rebels in Ottawa, but it's not really a good idea to be a rebel. It's a good idea to make your views known, and then to talk to your colleagues, engage in that dialogue internally. Because the whip, you know, it's like that game with the gophers keep popping up. He can hit 1 or 2, but if 20 or 30 of you pop up, then it's an issue, and you have to deal with it.
And of course, Jolene was a prophet as well. And that's, of course, another option. Cynicism and despair.
I'll just say the prophet I most admired, Elijah, he had a nice ending.
And he had a great vehicle. Yeah.
A couple of comments. One, talking about the role of the citizen. A few months ago, I had a discussion with about 30 university students about the role of the citizen. And when I asked them how many of them voted in the last election, and it was about 10% of them who had voted, I said, why didn't the rest of you vote? And they had this impression that nobody is going to listen to our agenda. It is the corporate agenda or the lobbyists who the government listens to. And therefore, what difference am I going to make? And this was 90% of a small group of 32 who felt that nobody was going to listen to them. So that was the impression that, you know, challenging to try and tell them you still have a responsibility as a Canadian to get involved because this is your country. If you don't get involved, then the lobbyists and the other special interest groups will have their say and you have to vote on their agenda. But you need to create your agenda. You need to, you know, go around and tell people, well, these are things that are important and let your MP know about it.
Yeah, let me give you a couple of examples. You can give to them. In our first term as government, we introduced legislation dealing with pharmaceuticals, natural health products. And there's been a natural health product directorate since 2004, strongly opposed by many people who take natural health products. There was a massive letter writing campaign to all members of parliament. I think I saw one story in the media over a 4-month period. I remember one lady who supported me for 15 years came to me and said, this is a bad piece of legislation. You know, frankly, it's all the pharmaceutical lobbyists who are convincing you of this. I said, well, how are they doing this with all the money they support? I said, corporations can't donate to political parties or political candidates in Canada. They can't. And I said, so Betty, the $40 you spent on that barbecue last summer is more than all the pharmaceutical companies have given to me over the last 5 years. She looked at me. Like, this is the reality in Canada. Is a citizen, going back to citizenship, has more influence than corporations that way. Also, the bill was not passed and has not been reintroduced. Because there are so many MPs who said there are so many people upset about this piece of legislation, and we're not sure about it, so we're not going to do it. That's example one. Example two is copyright legislation, which was introduced 2 sessions ago. Introduced, supported by the music industry, you know, all the artists and writers in Canada, you know, felt it even didn't go strong enough. There's a professor at the University of Ottawa, Michael Geist, and if any of you know copyright, he's very well known, basically started an online petition and Facebook site and basically stopped that legislation in its tracks. This was 2 parliaments ago. In the last parliament, we reintroduced it, but much more to his liking. Not completely to his liking, but much more to his liking. And I was meeting with him one day in the House of Commons lobby, and we've gotten to know each other quite well. And he said, you know, it's all these lobbyists on the other side. I said, Michael, you're more powerful than all the other lobbyists combined. Like, they wish they had your power, because you've energized a whole group of people across this country through a Facebook site. They would love to have that. Like you, and he said, well, I'm not that powerful. I said, you just stopped a piece of legislation. Not by yourself, but by your actions, which brought people together. And so these are examples of people can have influence that way.
But I think they don't hear enough stories that kind, and therefore watching whatever TV or whatever they read, it kind of becomes cynical quite young. And that's scary. The other comment I wanted to make, since you brought the Arab Spring now, you know, at the universities, after the Second World War, particularly in the 60s, most universities in North America, we started to teach about Russia. We taught about Russian politics, we taught about Russian art, we taught about Russian literature. A lot, you know, language was taught, a lot of that was taught at most of our universities. But with the Islamic world making 20% of the global population, none of that is, or very, very little of that is happening at universities. And, you know, there is tremendous literature from, you know, the Islamic world is pluralistic world, but there is absolutely fantastic literature, great culture, many, many different politics, many different thoughts. It'd be great, you know, to fund some of these things so that we can know the rest of the world a lot better.
What, do you want to answer that, Don?
Actually, I took Islamic philosophy with Don Carmichael. That was the course that actually introduced me to Don, and you bet there's a lot of really good readings in it. So I would say that out of my political philosophy courses, I've taken one on the Middle East and one on Islamic philosophy specifically. So it is being taught.
It is, but not as...
Yeah, that was the first time the course was taught.
When you look at the area of literature, culture,
And unfortunately, there was tragically, the professor who was heading that recently passed away, as you know. There's a dialogue. In the medieval period, there was an active dialogue between Christians like Aquinas and Averroes, you know, Islamic philosophers at that time. And in fact, it was the Arab world that brought forward most of the Western works from Aristotle to what we consider Western civilization. But there's also, even within the Islamic community, there's people from outside, you learn more as a politician because you go with your community, with the Ahmadiyya Muslim community. I mean, there's a lot of diversity within the Muslim community that a lot of people outside it do not recognize or know about, frankly.
I'd like to invite you to take it in a slightly different direction and still within the orbit of the things that the Ronning Center mandate is. I want to say I entirely agree with everything that you said. In fact, I asked I was stunned by this, but at the time of the last provincial election, I was teaching the honors students in political science in the fourth year class. And slightly over 40% of them voted in the last provincial election. That was actually lower than the provincial average.
And political science graduate.
These are honors students in political science. I was just stunned. And some of them will tell you, I have infinite patience and tolerance with students, but not that day. I just lost it. What is the matter with you? So that's a real problem. The broad education is educational institutions are always a generation behind. So we have these needs that are being filled very slowly. But in that connection, and I'd like to ask you something and maybe invite other people's comments too. For me, it's enormously interesting that we're having this discussion about the integrity of public life in a church. I mean, for me, that's just astonishing. And it's astonishing, astonishing in a number of ways. First of all, I'm not sure that if the Ronning Center just said, let's have that meeting and we're going to have it in a coffee house, I don't know whether people would come, whether they would relate to it. My suspicion, I may be wrong, I'd sure like for people to say this, my suspicion is that the kinds of things that you're talking about and that you, Mr. Mayor, raised and that Dom raised, that people from people who are practicing, I'm not, by the way, but people who are practicing
You don't need to practice. You master it.
Yeah, exactly.
People who are religious or in a practicing confessional community seem to be more confident about just saying things like, this is right, or this is wrong, or this is what we should do. Whereas other people seem, they'll throw stones or throw mud, but in terms of sort of stepping forward saying, I think we should do this, my impression, sort of looking at the students I teach and the community, is that the really deeply agnostic kids are also the ones who are really turned off politics and who are the most likely to say, why should I do anything? They don't do anything for me. When, of course, well, how could a person who spent 3.5 years studying politics say something so absolutely idiotic? You should take your degree. Now, but my question really for you, and by implication for the others, is it your sense that people from confessional communities or people who have religious faith, I'm not saying that they say, I'm a Catholic or I'm an evangelical and therefore, I'm not saying that at all, but just that they are more likely to be, to speak publicly on the things that matter?
I think they're more likely to speak in public forums on public matters. But I think others are maybe just as active in terms of communicating to you by email.
But that's private and easy.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And it's interesting, you know, if you look at the emails you get versus the phone calls versus public actual interactions, the most polite, productive dialogue is public interaction. Telephone would be second. Email is far away third. And in fact, you often get incredibly harsh, critical emails someone will send to you, and you'll say, I'll have to phone this person because I don't even know how to respond. You'll phone them, and they're shocked. They're sort of falling off their chair, saying, oh, I never thought you'd answer me because I presume you didn't care or didn't work at all. And then you actually sort of start a little dialogue. And, you know, one person who he was very harsh in his emails for about 3 years, and I just worked at it. Now he actually comes in twice a year, and we actually have a conversation. Not all of them end up that way. But I would say in general it's true. People in faith communities are more willing to come out and have a public dialogue. And frankly, you don't want to generalize too much, but the level of respect is much higher as well.
A recent study that I'm familiar with in Canada suggested that people who identify with religious communities are substantially more active in three areas: volunteerism, politics, and a third one. One last one, if we may.
When I was a child, we were brought up to respect politicians, the clergy, our teachers, everybody that's in authority, business people alike. But what I saw through the hippie movement, that the people that we were supposed to respect didn't deserve our respect. We know what has happened in the Catholic Church and in the Protestant churches over the years. And also business people have done a lot of weird things that people do not respect. Now, I believe that there's been this shift from being told to respect people, that now we demand, say, you as a politician, that you earn our respect, or a teacher earns our respect. And I'm involved in the oil and gas business, and that's all I hear, is I don't respect them all anymore. Now, from being told to respect, I believe now, as either politicians or clergy, we have to now earn that respect instead of being told we have to respect that person. Now, that's the big shift in all of society. Now, I also grew up in a gentleman there talked about it, Islam. I grew up with Lebanese. I went to school with them. Now, they said the same thing. The old settlers that came here in the 1920s, they said, if you want to be respected, you have to show that somebody can respect you. You have to earn it. And I really liked listening to them when I would talk with them as a child, how they came to Canada and how they earned that respect with all the different nationalities and religions here. Now, I see that there is a big shift among people. Nobody's happy with anybody anymore. It almost, even as a businessman, and with my employees, I have to earn respect. And I have to even go and tell my employee, okay, what do you think? What should we do? So it doesn't matter how stupid it sounds. Tell me. And what I have found is that even one word they would say that would change everything, even though everything else didn't make sense. I think that we have to start listening to people in such a way that instead of being thrown things at us, well, you're homophobic or you're Islamophobic or you're this, you're that, you're that, instead of really listening to what a person has to say without having to be put down. And I think, you know, I'm trying to get into politics also, but I see that we have to earn that respect now. Where before, we cannot depend on somebody telling us we're going to respect us.
Yeah, and I, it's a good point. Like, I have no objection to earning people's respect. And in fact, it's a good point that, you know, I mean, there were a whole series of incidents that happened where, you know, people in authority abuse that authority, so there was perhaps the pendulum that swung too far the other way. But that's, you know, I don't mind earning somebody's respect, but, you know, it's when people approach you and they're so cynical and so, they've taken such a hard position in terms of what a politician is, that you're, you know, it's almost impossible to earn their respect. Or the only way you do so is when they say, do this or else, and then you either do that and then somehow they're with you, or if you don't do that, then they're 100% opposed to you. Because earning respect should be, okay, I may have a different view, but I've listened to you, you've listened to me, we've had a dialogue, now I can respectfully disagree with you. I have no problem earning that respect, or at least attempting to.
Respect is only possible between human beings.
Yeah.
It's not possible to earn the respect if you think, or to ask somebody to assume that they can earn your respect if you think they're a demon. And that's a problem.
Yeah.
We demonize people, and then there's no context, there's no ground.
Yeah.
So that's part of what needs to be deconstructed. People need to be seen to have faces for that wonderful, marvelous biblical narrative. Human beings are created in the image and likeness of God, and that requires you to stand on different ground. Thanks.
I would just say that in municipal politics, it's much easier because we are so much closer to the people. We are doing that on a daily basis, either earning respect or earning our way out of doing this 3 years from now. It's very face-to-face, and it's real issues that people are dealing with every day. I find it very, very disappointing that James started out talking about how the media has had such a tremendous influence on what's happening, and I believe that they have accentuated all of the bad aspects of what I consider to be service to a community or service to the country, and have made it so that the word politician all just raises all kinds of bad images because of a few bad apples. And it is frustrating because that even comes down. You know, you get the Bogdanoviches or whatever in the United States, who create that feeling within people that all politicians are corrupt. Well, that comes all the way right back down to municipal politicians. Oh, you, there must be something in it for you. That's the why, reason you voted that way. I think over the next 20 years, it's going to be very hard to find committed people willing to step forward and serve.
Let's turn it around.
I hope so, and I think the faith community really does make a difference in that, because they are committed people, and it's more a feeling that I want to act my life like Jesus did, and that's my being. That's what I would carry forward. And those are the people that step forward.
But you're right, in terms of the media, like it is always an accentuation of the negative, and it's always an accentuation of conflict. There are a few who don't do that. There are a few, if you challenge them, they will. You know, like our committee, I mean, our finance committee will have, when the minister comes, they're all there because they want to see the conflict. When we have someone else on the study about tax evasion, which involves billions of dollars, which, you know, people with offshore accounts aren't paying taxes. I mean, a huge public policy issue, very important. You'll have maybe one reporter in the room for a couple of meetings. And you think, what's a bigger public policy importance to the country? So that's, they need to be challenged. But I think it also goes back to citizenship and public debates and dialogue, where, frankly, you almost bypass them more and more, and frankly harness a lot of these new technological tools, which I don't think we've quite grasped how to best do that. But part of it is, I mean, the Monk Center having public debates, putting them online, I mean, that's something, frankly, something this community think about doing, like have a debate in the Duke, and not about combative, here's two sides fighting, but actually here's an issue. We're just going to have a debate about...
Just walk around it from several directions. Yeah. Thank you so much, James.
Thank you.